In the 1660 book known as Martyr's Mirror, or The Bloody Theater, author Tielman J. Van Braught documented the stories and testimonies of Christian martyrs, particularly Anabaptists, in the Netherlands and surrounding areas. This is a description one man gave him of the experience he'd had. "And as they did still not obtain anything from me, to the implication of my neighbor, Master Hans took water, during the entire time a cloth had lain on my face, and holding my nose shut with one hand, began to pour water on my abdomen and thence all over my breast and into my mouth. I think that the can from which he poured out, the water held about 3 pints, and when I was at the end of my breath and wanted to fetch such, I drew the water all into my body, whereupon I suffered such distress that it would be impossible for me to relate or describe it. But the Lord be forever praised, he kept my lips. And when they could still not obtain anything from me, they caused the cord which was on my thigh to be loosed and applied to a fresh place, and wound it much tighter than before, so that I thought he would kill me, and began to shake and tremble greatly. He then proceeded to pour water into me again, so that I think he emptied 4 such cans, and my body became so full of it, that 2 times it came out again at the throat. And thus I became so weak that I fainted. For, when I recovered from my swoon, I found myself alone with Master Hans and Daniel de Keyser. And Master Hans was so busily engaged in loosing all my cords that it seemed to me that they were concerned over me. But the Lord, in a large degree, took away my pain every time. Whenever it became so severe that I thought it was impossible to bear it, my members became as dead. Eternal praise, thanks, honor, and glory be to the Lord, for when it was over I thought that, by the help of the Lord, I had fought a good fight." What this man endured was without doubt torture, and the tool used to facilitate his agony was simply water. They waterboarded him and forced water down his throat until he was literally filled to bursting. I included a visual in the Instagram for this episode, which came from a 17th century criminal law manual used by the Flemish Inquisition, which is probably a pretty accurate depiction of what this man went through, so feel free to check that out. His tormentors had weaponized water, which of course we all need to live and most of us probably enjoy in the right circumstances. Water is a double-edged sword, however, because as fun as it can be in a pool on a hot summer day, or as satisfying as a glass of water is when you're really, really thirsty, it has this little drawback of also being a substance that, in the right conditions, can kill us in less than a minute. Hello and welcome, my little creeplings. I am your host, Caroline, and for this episode, I decided it had been too long since I talked about torture. I talked about flaying specifically back in episode 1, and I sort of sideways talked about torture in the torture porn episode, but there is a big wide world of torture out there that we still haven't explored together. So today is water torture day. What are the various ways we sick humans have used our precious resource of water to inflict horrific abuse on each other? What actually happens to you and your body when you drown, or are made to keep gulping water continuously until you literally can't take another drop? Does dripping water on someone's head over and over again cause them to go insane? I tackle these questions, go over the history of the various forms of water torture, and bring you a few more harrowing descriptions of torment. And then I've got a Chinese folktale about a great flood for story time. Why would I force myself to do research on the ways our beloved water has been used to torture and kill? Because there is something about the fictionalized idea of water torture that is kinda creeptastic. So let's begin with the basics. What is water torture? Water torture is a term that can be applied to pretty much any torture technique that uses water to inflict physical and/or psychological harm on the victim, and it may or may not result in death. I would say if the intention is death, then technically that would be execution via water. But a lot of folks kind of lump all of this together because the reality is the process of using something like drowning to execute someone is definitely going to be a torturous experience for them right up until the moment of death. An awful, panic-ridden death by asphyxiation, from the first dunk to the final water-filled breath. Maybe that's only 20 seconds for the ones among us with little or unhealthy lungs. Maybe it's 40 seconds. Maybe even 60. And every single one of those seconds is filled with desperation for the air we need and the terrible, terrible knowledge that we can't get to it. Terrifying. Water is one of those paradoxical things that we require for life, but that can also easily kill us, just like the sun. Too much of a good thing, or a good thing used the wrong way, can make it a very, very bad thing. Personally, I love the water. My mom used to call me and my sister water babies, and I honestly can't remember a time when I did not know how to swim, float, tread water, all of that. If I didn't get motion sickness so damn much, I would probably be on the water a lot more in general. But usually I end up in some nice, pleasant, small body of water that doesn't have a whole lot of movement going on. I love me a nice swimming pool, maybe a lake, maybe a river. There's something that's incredibly soothing about just bobbing along and feeling the pressure of the water all around you, getting to float in weightlessness instead of being dragged down by gravity all the time. Delightful. I've even done the scuba diving thing and gone down to the depths where, frankly, no human should reasonably go when you really think about it. But honestly, I love being down at 80 feet even more than being on the surface, because down there, there is a kind of quiet that you never, ever get on land. It just feels blissful and vast and quiet. But I know, even in those quiet, blissful moments, that the water wrapped around me like a loving blanket is always, always trying to kill me. Always, at every single moment of its existence with mine. It does not care about me or my life. I know that if I want to enjoy the water, I have to play by its rules and make sure I can swim and tread water. You know, generally keep my airways attached to air. That's just the basics of human biology. We can't breathe through or underwater. If water's in our airways and lungs, air can't be. Simple as that. If both my nose and mouth slip below the surface and I can't or don't bring them back up, I die. Because what does my body demand to keep my little life going? Air. Sweet, precious air. So water. We love it, we need it, and it can easily and quickly kill us. And so, of course, it can also very effectively be utilized as a weapon. Like the case with many tools, it's just a matter of how you use it. We are going to look at some of the ways water has been weaponized over the centuries, because humans be fucked up creatures. But before I go into specific forms of water torture, I want to talk a little bit about the physiology of drowning. Just to give you some extra real appreciation for just how fucked up we humans are. Because at the heart of most forms of water torture is one central theme: threat of death by drowning. So what exactly is drowning? Drowning is a type of suffocation induced by a liquid blocking your airways from reaching the air. This could be through submersion, which is what most of us will think of when we think of drowning. Your basic head below surface situation. But as we'll see, you do not have to submerge someone in water to drown them, and no one has to die for drowning to have occurred. While the word drowning is commonly associated with fatal results, drowning is technically classified into three different types, which were agreed upon and reported out by the World Health Organization in 2005. There's drowning with death, drowning with ongoing health problems, and drowning with no ongoing health problems. What this means is that all that is required for drowning to occur is for enough of a liquid to be consistently applied to someone's airways to induce the process of suffocation. On a good day, water blocking your airways is as easily managed as getting away from the liquid. Just keep your head above water. Cough a little bit, clear things out of there. It doesn't mean that drowning as a process wasn't occurring, but yay, you didn't die and there probably won't be any lasting effects because you got your airway open again so quick. But the longer a liquid blocks your airways, the more likely it becomes that you will start to draw that liquid into your airways and lungs. And from there, shit gets real dicey. So what exactly happens in the body when drowning occurs? How does it kill you? In a nutshell, it prevents you from breathing, and if you don't breathe, your oxygen level will quickly become too low, and there will be too much carbon dioxide in your blood. If the brain has been out of oxygen for long enough, approximately 6 minutes, you die. If it lasts long enough, the process of drowning will typically go through 4 stages. First, you try to hold your breath. But before long, the urge to breathe becomes overwhelming due to the excess of carbon dioxide in your blood, which is setting off alarm bells in your brain. You'll probably feel a sense of growing panic as time keeps going and you still can't breathe. And in that panic, you are likely to thrash around, have a lot of rapid body movement, which, by the way, just uses up more oxygen in the bloodstream and reduces the time until you're unconscious. So try not to thrash if you're in a drowning situation. I know you're going to want to do differently. The second stage is a breaking point, when your body can't not breathe anymore, and it will try to draw a breath no matter what. And if your nose and mouth are surrounded by liquid and not air when this moment occurs, you will draw that liquid into your airways and possibly into your lungs. Instinctively, you'll try to cough it up, you'll try to swallow it, both of which will just make you inhale more water without meaning to. If you spend enough time in that state, then the complete deprivation of oxygen to your brain will stop your breathing and aspiration, and you will have reached the 3rd stage of the drowning process. Eventually, cerebral injury due to this oxygen deprivation becomes irreversible. And if the process continues to be uninterrupted, you will reach the 4th stage. Loss of consciousness due to hypoxia, followed rapidly by cardiac arrest. Obviously, you can still be resuscitated at that point. It's just a matter of how quickly that kind of attention is given to you or if it's given at all. So that's what we're dealing with in the majority of water tortures. Part of the torture is the very real threat of death from drowning. The other part of the torture is just our psychological awareness of that. It is a physical as well as a psychological torture. Double whammy, don't like it. But let's examine the methods that people have used which would fall into the water torture category, starting with the most well-known and possibly most used method of water torture out there, waterboarding. Sounds benign on the face of it, doesn't it? Might refer to a kindly old lady washing linens in a stream, using a rough board to scrub off a stain. Alas, that is not what waterboarding is. As I'm sure you have heard, if not seen, waterboarding is a form of torture in which water is poured over a cloth covering the face and breathing passages of an immobilized person, causing them to experience a modified form of drowning. A lot of the literature that I found on this liked to talk about, quote, the sensation of drowning or simulated drowning. But as I've already described for you, that kind of phrasing is just bullshit. Waterboarding does induce the psychological and physiological process of drowning. Full stop. It's not a simulation. It's not a sensation that's like drowning. In actual waterboarding, someone is actually being drowned. It's just in an intermittent fashion, which isn't usually intended to cause death. Though, of course, it can. In the most common method of waterboarding, the victim's face is covered with cloth or some other thin material, and they are completely immobilized on their back, sometimes flat or sometimes at an incline of 10 to 20 degrees. The torturer will pour water onto the face over the nose and mouth, which causes an almost immediate gag reflex and begins the drowning process. Like I said, normally this pouring is intermittent, so the drowning process doesn't usually continue to the point of significant lasting physical damage or death. But if the water is poured for long enough, without interruption, it will lead to death by asphyxia, which is sometimes called dry drowning if water hasn't made it all the way to your lungs, but has obstructed your airways. And here's the terrifying reality. We have absolutely no way of knowing for any given person where their long enough point really is. Waterboarding is bad fucking news. It can cause extreme pain, damage to the lungs, brain damage from oxygen deprivation, lasting psychological damage like PTSD, and other physical injuries like broken bones if the victim struggles violently enough against their restraints because they're trying to breathe. Adverse physical effects can last for months, psychological effects for years. One patient who received treatment at the Bellevue Hospital New York University Program for Survivors of Torture reported that despite their waterboarding having taken place years prior, they were still unable to take showers and panicked whenever it rained. And that is fucking heartbreaking. The term waterboard torture appeared in press reports as early as 1976. But as a practice, waterboarding has been in use all over the world and at various points in history, including all the following: by interrogators in the Spanish and Flemish Inquisitions, by the United States military during the Philippine-American War, the Vietnam War, and the War on Terror, by Japanese and German officials during World War II, by the French in the Algerian War, by the Pinochet regime in Chile, by the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, by the British Army in Northern Ireland, and by South African police during the apartheid era. Humans be fucked up creatures. And clearly that knows no nationality. One of the reasons that it has been favored over some other torture methods, and probably why it has continued to persist to this day, is because, unlike most other torture techniques, it produces no marks or wounds on the body. Huzzah! We can feel better about ourselves because if there's no marks, then clearly no damage has been done, right? No one's going to complain about abuse. There's not a single mark on him. Marks or no marks, waterboarding has been historically viewed as an especially severe form of torture. Unless maybe you're writing an official report for a government who would rather not have such a distasteful term applied to their interrogation practices. I think you all know what I'm talking about. The use of waterboarding became very well known and a matter of public controversy in the United States during the War on Terror in the 2000s. As far as what we definitely have documented in the public domain, we know that in 2002 and 2003, the CIA waterboarded at least 3 Al-Qaeda suspects. That said, do any of us really believe that it was just those 3 that got waterboarded? Really? You're welcome to if you want, but personally, I am too fucking cynical for that. If it happened to 3 we know about, it happened to a shit ton more that we still don't know about. Who could say how many? But it was more than 3. Come on now. The CIA relied on the formerly secret torture memos, which were prepared by the Department of Justice's Office of Legal Counsel, and authorized the use of the so-called enhanced interrogation techniques on extrajudicial prisoners of the United States. Here is a direct quote from a top-secret 2002 memorandum in which CIA representatives detailed the precise process they went through to waterboard a detainee. And as I read this, I want you to close your eyes and imagine this process is being applied to you, because it makes the clinical way they describe it even more terrifying. In this procedure, the individual is bound securely to an inclined bench, which is approximately 4 feet by 7 feet. The individual's feet are generally elevated. A cloth is placed over the forehead and eyes. Water is then applied to the cloth in a controlled manner. As this is done, the cloth is lowered until it covers both the nose and mouth. Once the cloth is saturated and completely covers the mouth and nose, airflow is slightly restricted for 20 to 40 seconds due to the presence of the cloth. During those 20 to 40 seconds, water is continuously applied from a height of 12 to 24 inches. After this period, the cloth is lifted, and the individual is allowed to breathe unimpeded for 3 or 4 full breaths. The procedure may then be repeated. The water is usually applied from a canteen cup or small watering can with a spout. The procedure would not last more than 20 minutes in any one application. Ah! That is just creepy as shit to read something like that in that just very bland clinical kind of way. And that's just what the official notes say, by the way. Who wants to take bets that some people weren't quite so precise or really watching the clock that closely? Yeah, you don't want to take that bet. So for 20 minutes, you are strapped to a board while someone pours water over your precious, precious airways for 20 to 40 seconds. And remember, that is long enough for some people to die from drowning, depending on the state and size of their lungs. Then you get to gasp for 3 or 4 breaths if your torturer is feeling generous, and then they just do it again. That anyone has ever been able to justify to themselves that that's not torture is very incomprehensible to me. If that's not torture, I'm not entirely sure what is. By the way, CIA officers who have subjected themselves to waterboarding have only lasted an average of 14 seconds before refusing to continue. So they reached their breaking point at second 14, but the standard for detainees was 20 to 40 seconds per pour. Yeah, ain't nobody gonna ever convince me that wasn't about torturing someone with the threat of death. And that's what this is, because that is exactly what drowning is, a threat to our life. I like how John McCain described waterboarding in 2011. I think it sums up very simply and elegantly why waterboarding is, a form of torture. He referred to it as a, quote, mock execution. And that just hit the nail on the head for me. It is. It is an ongoing threat of death. It's a torment from which there is no escape. It is, in some ways, no different than tying someone down and putting a gun to their head so that they have to live every moment thinking about the fact that the only thing between them and death is a trigger finger. Yeah, that's torture. Thankfully, enough people agree with my assessment of the shitshow that is waterboarding that after some investigations and a whole lot of news reports and outrage and all of that good stuff, the United States officially banned the use of waterboarding and other forms of torture in interrogations of detainees by any government agency, including the dreaded CIA. And this happened back in January 2009, which feels way too recent to me. I also found a quote about waterboarding in my research that I feel I have to share with you guys because it just makes me laugh. In May of 2009, so that was a few months after the official torture ban, Jesse the Body Ventura was quoted as describing waterboarding as follows. Waterboarding is drowning. It gives you the complete sensation that you are drowning. It is no good because you... I'll put it to you this way. You give me a waterboard, Dick Cheney, in 1 hour, and I'll have him confess to the Sharon Tate murders. It makes me laugh just because I know that Jesse Ventura is a former state governor, but to me, he will always be Blaine Cooper from the original Predator movie. Just spitting tobacco, just wrecking entire forests with his giant fucking gun. So to me, no matter what he says, I hear it coming from 1980s Predator Jesse Ventura, and it makes everything very comical. I ain't got time to bleed. Since we're on the topic, let's look at a few other examples of waterboarding through the ages, shall we? During the French-Algerian War, which ran from 1954 to 1962, French journalist Henri Allais, who was subjected to waterboarding by French paratroopers in Algeria in 1957, is one of only a few people to have described in writing the first-hand experience of being waterboarded. After he had been strapped to a plank and his head wrapped in cloth, he was positioned under a running tap. Saying of it, "The rag was soaked rapidly. Water flowed everywhere, in my mouth, in my nose, all over my face. But for a while I could still breathe in some small gulps of air. I tried, by contracting my throat, to take in as little water as possible, and to resist suffocation by keeping air in my lungs for as long as I could. But I couldn't hold on for more than a few moments. I had the impression of drowning, and a terrible agony, that of death itself, took possession of me. In spite of myself, all the muscles of my body struggled uselessly to save me from suffocation. In spite of myself, the fingers of both my hands shook uncontrollably." "That's it, he's going to talk," said a voice. The water stopped running, and they took away the rag. I was able to breathe. In the gloom, I saw the lieutenants and the captain, who, with a cigarette between his lips, was hitting my stomach with his fist to make me throw out the water I had swallowed. Fucking hell. In case you were wondering, in addition to surviving this ordeal, Alais did not break under this torture. Bon pour vous, Henri. Bon pour vous. Here's another example that pissed me the fuck off and made me feel ashamed of my own country, which happens far more often than I'd like. In 1983, the sheriff of San Jacinto County in Texas, James Parker, and three of his deputies were convicted for conspiring to force confessions. The complaint said they, quote, "subject prisoners to a suffocating water torture ordeal to coerce confessions. This generally included the placement of a towel over the nose and mouth of the prisoner, and the pouring of water into the towel until the prisoner began to move, jerk, twitch, or otherwise indicate suffocation and or drowning." Yeah, that fits the waterboarding definition quite well. Fits nicely. Here's the part that really pissed me off, though. For the crime of waterboarding, often innocent people, in order to get them to confess to crimes they did not commit, James Parker was only sentenced to 10 years in prison, and his deputies to 4 years. I gotta say, if some cops pulled me in for questioning and then held me down and waterboarded me until I confessed to something I didn't do just to, I don't know, make their fucking stats look good, I would not be satisfied with the pieces of shit who did it going to prison for what's basically a handful of years. What they did to me is beyond fucked up, because it was a sheriff, a person in position of power, an officer who literally has sworn to uphold justice and the law, who did that to multiple people. I can't say what an appropriate punishment for that would be, but I will say that to me, 10 years does not feel like enough for that kind of abuse of power. I wish for him nothing but painful hemorrhoids for the rest of his life so that he can never comfortably sit down again. That's what I wish. All right, leaving my rage behind now. One question that always comes up when you get into any discussion about waterboarding, or any torture which is being used for the sake of getting information out of someone, is, of course, does it work? I don't feel the need to get into some big debate about whether torture is ever justified and all of that jazz, but I will say that in general, a lot of the literature out there agrees with my own very basic response to that question, which is yes, of course it works. Of course it will make someone talk. Some people will sing and dance for you if you even threaten to torture them. But will they necessarily tell you anything remotely useful or necessarily true? Nah, they won't. Torture is great for getting people to confess, but a lot of times it's because they want the torture to stop, not because they're guilty. And you will never ever be able to convince me that a confession elicited by torture or the threat of torture can ever be 100% trusted. Personally, I wouldn't trust such a confession at all. But waterboarding isn't the only water torture out there. Oh no. How else have we fucked up humans weaponized water? One form of torture that is sometimes lumped in as a variation of waterboarding has an even more tame-sounding name. The water cure. Oh, it's a cure? Excellent! I love a good cure for what ails me. How does it work? Simple. I'll tie you down so you can't get away, and then I'm going to force you to drink water until you're literally about to burst. Yeah, that's not going to cure what ails me. That is correct. The so-called water cure is in fact a torture in which the victim is forced to drink large quantities of water, or sometimes other things like bile or urine, in a very short period of time, which results in gastric distension, also known as a nice big ol' swollen belly, water intoxication, which is a disturbance in brain function that happens when your normal balance of electrolytes gets all fucked up by excessive water intake, and, of course, death. Here's how it works. The victim usually has their mouth forced or wedged open, and a funnel or strip of cloth is forced down their throat. Then their nose is closed with pincers, which results in the victim having to drink all the liquid that is poured into the funnel in order to avoid drowning. Where's all that liquid supposed to go? Their stomach fills and swells until it seems about to burst and the person is too full to take anymore. Then, maybe if the torturer is feeling whimsical, they'll beat the victim's distended stomach until they vomit so the torture can begin again. I found reports of people being punched in the stomach to get the water back out, of being rolled around and pushed down on the ground to make it come out, of people getting on top of the person and jumping on their belly, like they're trying to pop a fucking water balloon. Yes, that should happen. So I have a question. Why the fuck would this be called a cure? There's a reason. It's a fucked up reason, but it's there. So like waterboarding, the process of this so-called water cure is centuries old. But the first use of the phrase water cure in the torturous sense is indirectly dated to around 1898, turn of the century, when U.S. soldiers in the Spanish-American War ironically referred to the torture they were inflicting on their enemies as a water cure, after that phrase was introduced to America in the mid-19th century. But what it referred to before the soldiers had their little joke was what we now call hydrotherapy, or the use of water for therapeutic purposes. Random side note, I fucking love a hydrotherapy pool. Just hot water blasting from all directions, working out on all my sore spots. Ugh, delightful. But these fucking douchebags had to take something awesome like relaxing in a hot tub and ruin it by perpetually forcing water down someone's throat and then making jokes with each other about how it was a form of therapy or cure. Humans are such fucked up creatures. And the name stuck, because I guess enough other people found it hilarious. And now history's been written, and I'm telling you about a torture method, which is called a cure. Blah. More examples of this cure being administered to the unwilling, and there's a lot of them. So as you listen, definitely remember, these are not isolated incidents. Survivors of the Amboina massacre, which was perpetrated by the Dutch in the East Indies in 1623, described what they saw as follows. First, they hoisted him up by the hands with a cord on a large door, where they made him fast upon two staples of iron, fixed on both sides, at the top of the doorposts, having his hands one from the other as wide as they could stretch. Being thus made fast, his feet hung some 2 foot from the ground, which also they stretched asunder as far as they would stretch, and so made them fast beneath unto the door trees on each side. Then they bound a cloth about his neck and face so close that little or no water could go by. That done, they poured the water softly upon his head until the cloth was full, up to the mouth and nostrils, and somewhat higher, so that he could not draw breath, but he must withal suck in the water, which, being still continued to be poured in softly, forced all his inward parts, come out of his nose, ears, eyes, and often, as it were stifling and choking him, at length took away his breath, and brought him to a swoon or fainting. Then they took him quickly down and made him vomit up the water. Being a little recovered, they trussed him up again and poured water as before, taking him down as soon as he seemed to be stifled. In this manner they handled him three or four several times with water, until his body was swollen twice or thrice as big as before, his cheeks like great bladders, and his eyes staring and strutting out beyond his forehead. Ooh. If that hadn't happened to a real person, I would say that was really fucking creeptastic, if that was like in a movie or a story or something like that, but when it's real, fuck. In the 17th and 18th centuries, the French called the water cure process being put to the question. The process, known as the ordinary question, involved the forcing of 1 gallon, or approximately 3.6 liters, of water into the stomach. Then, there was the extraordinary question, which involved the forcing of 2 gallons, or approximately 7.3 liters. The Spanish Inquisition had the water cure on their expansive torture menu. Scottish traveler William Lithgow endured this torture at their hands in 1620 and described his ordeal in the book Rare Adventures and Painful Peregrinations, what a title, published in 1632. Quote, "The first and second measures of water I gladly received, such was the scorching drought of my tormenting pain, and likewise I had drunk none for 3 days before. But afterward, at the third charge, perceiving these measures of water to be inflicted upon me as tortures, oh, strangling tortures, I closed my lips, gainstanding that eager crudelity. Whereat the alcalde, enraging, set my teeth asunder with a pair of iron cadges, detaining them there, at every several turn, both mainly and manually. Whereupon my hunger-clunged belly, waxing great, grew drum-like and bolstered. For it being a suffocating pain, in regard of my head hanging downward, and the water re-engorging itself in my throat with a struggling force, it strangled and swallowed up my breath from yowling and groaning." The water cure was also among the forms of torture used by American soldiers on Filipinos during the Philippine-American War of 1899 to 1902. A report at the time noted, quote, "A soldier who was with General Funston had stated that he helped to administer the water cure to 160 natives, all but 26 of whom died." Lieutenant Grover Flint described the technique they used as follows. "A man is thrown down on his back and three or four men sit or stand on his arms and legs and hold him down, and either a gun barrel or a rifle barrel or a carbine barrel or a stick as big as a belaying pin, that is, with an inch circumference, is simply thrust into his jaws and his jaws are thrust back. And, if possible, a wooden log or stone is put under his head or neck so he can be held more firmly. In the case of very old men, I have seen their teeth fall out. I mean when it was done a little roughly. He is simply held down, and then water is poured onto his face, down his throat and nose from a jar, and that is kept up until the man gives some sign or becomes unconscious. And, when he becomes unconscious, he is simply rolled aside and he is allowed to come to. In almost every case, the men have been a little roughly handled. They were rolled aside rudely, so that water was expelled. A man suffers tremendously, there is no doubt about it. His sufferings must be that of a man who is drowning, but cannot drown." And this one's a weird one for me because I'm half Filipino, and so any connection to the Philippines just kind of rings that little bell in my brain. And I've been there. My grandparents lived in what was essentially a suburb of the capital, Manila, and I had visited them there for a while when I was younger. So it is terrifying to picture in my mind what I remember of that place and the people there, and imagine this kind of thing happening. Not a good time in my brain, no. I could go on and on with these examples, but I don't have the stomach and you don't need to hear essentially the same story over and over again. It's awful every fucking time. Let's turn to a new form of water torture, one which did not originate in China, but which we still call Chinese. Yep, the Chinese water torture, or as some call it, more appropriately, dripping torture, or using a dripping machine. This involves water, but not the risk of death. This is all about mental torture. Instead of terrorizing the victim with the fear of drowning, dripping torture is a process where cold water is slowly dripped onto someone's scalp, forehead, or face for a prolonged period of time. That's it. Sounds pretty tame on the face of it, I know. Apparently not as tame as you might think, because it tends to make people go nutso. The process causes fear and mental deterioration in its subject. Psychosis is another common effect in which victims experience delusions, hallucinations, and can even completely lose touch with reality. The pattern of the drops is irregular, and the cold sensation is jarring, which causes the person to have perpetual anxiety trying to anticipate the next drip. This form of torture was first described by Hippolytus de Marcellus, who is credited as having invented this form of torture in Italy in the 15th or 16th century. So why not call it Italian water torture? No one's totally sure, but the earliest known reference to the phrase Chinese water torture is from the 1892 short story The Compromiser, which at least tells us that there was some public familiarity with that term by that point. Others have asserted that it's called the Chinese water torture because the phrase itself was popularized by Harry Houdini's predicament escape, known as the Chinese water torture cell, which he introduced in 1910. Ironically, his cell had nothing whatsoever to do with dripping. All it entailed was him being bound and suspended upside down in a locked glass and steel cabinet, which was full to the brim with water. So why is dripping torture Chinese water torture? We'll probably never know, for the same reason that Greenland ain't so green. It's just one of those weird things. Regardless of what you call it, it looks like the same thing. De Marcellus apparently invented it after observing how drops of water falling one by one on a stone gradually created a hollow, and decided to apply the method to the human body. What a fucked up progression of thought. According to his method, the victim would be stripped of their clothes, shown to the public, then tortured. They would be driven insane while bystanders watched, mocked, and laughed at them. The victims could see each drop coming, and after a long duration of time, were gradually driven frantic to the point of insanity, usually because they were led to believe that a hollow or severe ulcer would develop where the water was striking them, just like it would a stone. Even if someone didn't believe that, the combined result of prolonged restraint under irritating conditions and the humiliation of being tortured publicly would definitely be more than enough to cause severe agitation, let's say. The public humiliation part of that is what really sticks with me. That makes it all feel so much uglier than just one person torturing another. That makes this whole thing a shared human event. And that creeps me out. Ugh. So is the dripping torture really that effective? The Mythbusters investigated the effectiveness of the so-called Chinese water torture. They noted that the restraining equipment was providing most of that effect by itself, and when they tested the dripping water alone on a relaxed and unrestrained subject, it was found almost negligible. However, they used a constant drip, which had a predictable rhythm. In episode 3, season 2 of the web television series Mindfield, Mythbusters host Adam Savage said the following: "The creepiest thing that happened after we did this episode was that I got an email from someone from a throwaway account. He said, 'We found that randomizing when the drops occurred was incredibly effective, that anything that happens on a regular periodicity can become a type of meditation, and you can then tune it out. If you couldn't predict it,' he said, 'we found we were able to induce a psychotic break within 20 hours. Yeah, that would be a super creepy email to get. Yikes. Last but of course never least, I will talk about devices which thankfully are no longer in widespread use, known as cucking stools or ducking stools. These were chairs which were used for the punishment of disorderly women, scolds, and dishonest tradesmen in England and Scotland. I had to look up what they meant by scolds as a noun, and here's what that referred to. a troublesome and angry person who broke the public peace by habitually chastising, arguing, and quarreling with their neighbors. Holy shit! So every single complainy Kathy on the internet. I wish that were less true. It may or may not surprise you to hear that back in the day, scolds were almost always in female form. What a trend. Wonder why that could be. Yes, the good old cucking stool was most typically a form of punishment for women. A way to publicly humiliate and censure them for backbiting or sexual offenses like bearing an illegitimate child or prostitution. What can I say? Bitches be crazy. There was no standard design for the stools. Most were simply chairs into which the offender could be tied and exposed at their door or the site of their offense, so you and I could call them names and shit like that. Some were on wheels that could be dragged around the parish so you could turn your scold into a sideshow, and some were put on poles so that they could be plunged into water. Hence, ducking stool. Usually, the chair was fastened to a long wooden beam fixed as a seesaw on the edge of a pond or river. And I have an illustration of that on the Instagram for this episode if you want to look. Sometimes, however, the ducking stool was not a fixture but was mounted on a pair of wooden wheels so that it could be wheeled through the streets and at the river edge was hung by a chain from the end of a beam. In sentencing someone, the magistrates ordered the number of duckings they should have. One ducking, two ducking, three. The term cucking stool is older than ducking stool, with written records dating back to the 13th and 14th centuries. Written records for the term ducking stool appear from 1597, and a statement in 1769 relates that ducking stool is just a corruption of the term cucking stool. Whereas a cucking stool could be and was used for humiliation with or without dunking the person in water, the name ducking stool came to be used more specifically for cucking stools fixed to an oscillating plank which were used to duck the person into water. Makes sense. The cucking stool appears to have still been in use as late as the early 19th century. The last recorded cases are those of a Mrs. Gamble at Plymouth in 1808, Jenny Pipes, a, quote, notorious scold, in 1809, and Sarah Leek in 1817. In the last case, the water in the pond was so low that the offender was merely wheeled around the town in the chair. How about some other random examples of water tortures? And let's add some temperature to the mix. During World War II, the Hungarian Nazi Party turned a regular 19th century villa in Budapest into what is now known as the House of Terror. And there, all manner of torture was inflicted by whoever the Nazis weren't digging on any given day. That included a lot of people. One torture device kept in the House of Terror was a water chamber, which was really just a large hole that had a small platform in the middle where a sleep-deprived victim was forced to stand, surrounded by freezing cold water. So the consequences of not standing or falling asleep was freezing cold death. Have you heard of Unit 731? I kinda wish I hadn't now that I know about it, but it is so chock full of ridiculously horrific material, I might have to dedicate an entire episode to it at some point. Also known as the Ishii Unit, Unit 731 was a Japanese covert biological and chemical warfare R&D unit back in World War II, led by a fucking monster named Ishii Shiro. He called himself Doctor. Monster feels more appropriate to me. Here's why. World War II prisoners of war and Chinese natives were not considered human to him. He literally referred to them as logs, because to him, they were simply tools to be used, burned, and discarded. And that is a fucked up mentality in of itself. But he was really pushing his limits. In the name of science, Shiro executed some truly horrific experiments on some very unwilling and very much alive victims. One experiment we know about was called the Frostbite Test. Unit 731 was based in northeast China, where it gets very, very cold during the winter. And that gave Shiro an idea. He decided to force men and women to stand naked in the freezing cold as soldiers doused their limbs with cold water in order to speed up the onset of frostbite. This would continue until the limbs were hard enough to elicit a ringing sound when they were hit with sticks. Once that had been achieved, victims either had their limbs and fingers smashed off or immediately defrosted by hot water, which caused all the flesh on the limbs to just slide off. Blah! And then there's therapeutic showers. Before it was common for people to have things like running water or a means of heating that running water, showers for purposes of cleaning yourself were much less of a thing. Today, you say shower, and I think of a lovely, hot, steamy, relaxing experience, which probably comes with yummy-smelling soap. That's not the kind of shower that I'm talking about. The study of mental health and psychology has a very dark history, which I will definitely be doing an episode or 12 on someday. But for today's episode, I'll just give you one example of what used to be thought of by medical professionals as a good idea for the treatment of mental illness. I want you to remember that as I tell you because it boggles my fucking mind. Back in the 1700s, it was believed that mania was the equivalent of a violent heat that boiled the blood and dried out the brain. In other words, someone behaving aggressively who is super escalated would be considered to be literally hot-headed. And if you believe that it's really just a matter of temperature, then I understand how cooling the brain seems like an obvious solution. Heat equals insanity? Right, let's just chill everything out. Here's how a Dr. Blair claims to have effected this cure from a letter he wrote to a colleague. I cured a man raving mad, who being bound in a cart, stripped of his clothes and blindfolded, that the surprise might be the greater. He on a sudden had a great fall of water let down on him from the height of 20 foot, under which he continued so long as his strength would permit. And after his return home, he fell into a sleep and slept 29 hours, and awaked in as quiet a state of mind as ever, and so had continued to the time of writing this letter, which was 12 months. He went on to surmise that, quote, a hot brain being the cause, perhaps, of several disorders in the understanding, and is in great part found to be true in the ridiculous behavior of some drunken men, which, when their heads are become cool, abhor what they before did do or say. So he's literally saying that a guy whose head is hot because he's angry in a bar fight, once he's cooled down, oh, he's just back to normal. And that's his justification for putting someone through a freezing cold shower shock treatment, essentially. So getting all those crazy hotheads cold again was the priority for a while, probably a lot longer than any of us would be comfortable knowing. Cold water showers designed to shock, henceforth referred to as cold water shock showers, were thought to exert an influence on the will. Passion was thought to subdue passion, so if someone is being too passionate and escalated, how do we de-escalate them? Apparently, with fear. French physician Philippe Pinet proposed in 1794 that, quote, one of the major principles of the psychologic management of the insane is to break their will in a skillfully timed manner, without causing wounds or imposing hard labor. Okay, I'm feeling all right. Skillful timing, no wounds, no hard labor, sounding okay so far. But then he says, rather, a formidable show of terror should convince them that they are not free to pursue their impetuous willfulness, and that their only choice is to submit. Whew, suddenly I feel a chill. So how do they make a shower so scary that someone would submit, as Pinet put it? First, the shower started unexpectedly. That unexpected bit always drives us nuts. And second, the shower would continue for as long as the patient could physically endure, creating an increasingly panicky fear of death. The primal heat and passion of the mentally ill that doctors perceived was interpreted at that time as signs of power and strength rather than illness. So it was also believed that the mentally ill would be just fine if they were denied basic needs like food or warmth. The cold shock fall of water was therefore prescribed for an extended time, and made to fall with force. Because force is what's needed in order to break down the unusually strong will of the insane. The goal was quite literally to break these people, completely break their will, show no regard for even their most basic of needs. I am describing some of the worst tortures that one human can put another through, and this was considered healthcare. It is always super difficult for me to, at least initially, wrap my brain around how anyone, let alone doctors, could do these kinds of things to people. Difficult, but not impossible. Because of course, as is the case with a lot of awful shit we humans have done, they thought they were helping. Alright, before I really close this out, I wanted to share one other weird thing that I came across that I just didn't even know where the hell to put it. I did not know that this existed. If you did, or if you actually saw it or used it, please let me know, because this sounds banoodles to me. There was something at Coney Island in Brooklyn, New York, called the Coney Island Waterboarding Thrill Ride. That existed. Very briefly, but that existed. It was conceived by conceptual artist Steve Powers in mid-2008. As built, the thrill ride was a diorama where viewers would mount stairs to a window where they would see a tableau of two fake models, one a captive, one a masked interrogator. The captive was wearing an orange uniform and was spread-eagled on a tilted table. Viewers would insert a dollar so the interrogator figure would pour water onto a rag over the captive figure's nose and throat, upon which the captive figure would start convulsing. Holy shit. As you might imagine, that didn't stay up very long. About 2 months in total, in fact. And if you're asking why, I'm a little worried about you, because come on, how the fuck is that an appropriate thrill ride to just squish in the middle of a row of ordinary, like, carnival games and concession stands? Which, by the way, is exactly where they put it. It wasn't in, like, some trigger warning, adult-only type situation or anything. They were just like, boom, here you go, stick your dollar in. And by the way, to me, that just makes the whole thing sound so much more fucked up. The money part? Because they're basically asking kids to give them a dollar to have someone waterboarded. Like, hi, torturer, here's a dollar. Will you do your show for me? And he's like, cool, let me waterboard this person. I mean, it's just, I don't even know what to do with that. Kind of gives me a really big what the fuck kind of moment. And it seemed, you know, at the time, that the world in general agreed. When he was questioned about it, Powers told the New York Times that his purpose in preparing the display was educational, saying, quote, "What's more obscene, the official position that waterboarding is not torture, or our official position that it's a thrill ride? Robot waterboarding became a way of exploring the issue without doing any harm. It's putting a unique experience on the table, and it doesn't take a great leap of the imagination to look in there and say, that's really what's going on? That's crazy." Yeah, I feel like if education was your goal, you would have it in a museum or a school. You wouldn't make people pop a dollar in the machine to see the waterboarding while they eat cotton candy. It just feels really sleazy to me, if I'm being totally honest. And I kind of wish he would just admit that rather than trying to claim, oh, I was trying to educate the kids on this very important issue. Uh-huh. At the Coney Island theme park, where they go to be entertained. So what about in popular horror media? As I was looking for instances of specifically water torture, I quickly discovered that for whatever reason, horror movies that have torture don't tend to have a whole lot of water torture. And I think that might be for the simple reason that it's just not as visually horrific as, say, ripping off someone's fingernails, or anything else that draws blood and gets a lot of sweating and screaming going. Obviously, an audience would recognize that it's still torture, but the point of movies and TVs is that they have that super stimulating visual component, and water tortures just aren't as visually compelling as other forms of torture. I also discovered that, especially when it comes to waterboarding, we do not tend to associate that with the type of sadistic torture that is usual for horror films. We associate it with interrogational torture, something you do when you want to get someone to talk. And because of that, where it shows up in movies and TV, it is usually being used for that purpose, mostly in genres other than horror. Shows up a lot when any drug cartel is involved in a storyline. A lot in war movies, sometimes cop movies, situations where we've heard about waterboarding occurring, right? So typically classified as thrillers, action movies, dramas, all of that. But very few, if any, straight-up horror films, which I kind of found interesting to think about. I'd be curious for your thoughts on why that might be, dear listener. Feel free to email me, message me. Creeptastic.com has everything you might need to do that. I'm curious. So of the films I'm about to mention, keep in mind that not all of them would be considered strictly horror, but they do have notable depictions of water torture and are at least what I like to call horror adjacent. There was a movie back in 1965 called Bloody Pit of Horror. The 60s had like a fit of movies with medieval tortures that I found. I found two more at least in this decade, just in the course of researching this episode, but there was no specific water torture in those. The plot of this gothic horror film sets you up for a lot of gratuitousness. A group of people, including five sexy young models, their photographer, and a writer with his publisher and secretary, go into a deserted castle to take some pictures for their horror photo novella. But it's not deserted. A former actor has been living in it. Against his warning, the group go into the dungeon to shoot photos, which enrages our crazed actor into becoming the Crimson Executioner, a man executed centuries earlier for being a sadistic torturer. And one by one, all but two of our sexy young people will be tortured, including a little non-Chinese Chinese water torture, and murdered. It sounds pretty awful. Possibly in a good way, I'm not totally sure. However, since there was kind of a dearth of water torture movies that I could find, I decided that I will take a chance and I will watch it for the spoiling this week. I promise I won't do another old movie for a while after that. But of my options, I feel the most intrigued by this one right now. Is it going to be shitty or so shitty it's good? If you want to find out with me on the after show, as told by Caroline, you should visit my Patreon page at patreon.com/creeptastic and sign up to be a patron of the show. A mere $5 a month gets you all the weekly after shows, a monthly bonus episode, and my entire back catalog. There are more perks as well if you feel like giving even more money. You may take a look at all the options at patreon.com/creeptastic. Patrons also receive my everlasting love and gratitude because they fund my dreams, and that makes them fucking awesome. Back to water torture on film. There was a 1998 movie called The Visitors 2, The Corridors of Time. It was a French film, I'd never heard of it before. The storyline involves potions and time travel and quite a lot of ridiculousness from what I could tell, so I won't bore you with that. But it does actually depict someone being tortured via the water cure, and I watched a clip of that online. There's definitely a funnel, piped water, lots of spluttering. Not really super graphic or honestly even that believable looking, so not really scary, but there it is. In the year 2000, a movie called The Cell came out. And this is one that has made it to my semi-guilty pleasures list. I only feel semi-guilty about it. I definitely like it. It's usually described as a psychological thriller rather than a horror movie. But if you've seen it, I think you will agree that there are some pretty creeptastic horror kind of moments in there. One that always stuck with me is the water chamber in this movie. If you're unfamiliar with it, a team of scientists led by Jennifer Lopez, yes, I said Jennifer Lopez, must go into the mind of a comatose serial killer in order to find his last victim before she dies. Some really interesting visuals throughout the whole thing, but the water chamber is one that haunts me, and for a few different reasons. So a captive woman is put in a cell, which has thick glass walls and is super solidly built, but definitely in a dark basement, concrete walls, no windows. Creeptastic already. Doesn't seem so bad at first. There's a tray of food for her. There's a prison cell style toilet sink combo situation. There's a bench to sit on. But then, as the movie progresses, the cell is slowly filled with water, which blasts down from sprinklers very heavily and at random intervals. So she doesn't know when the water is coming, and once it's on, she doesn't know how long it will be on. And this continues over the course of multiple days. Just keeps happening. The water keeps rising, and she has to endure that sheer panic of constantly living in the knowledge that she will eventually drown because the cell is watertight. But all she can do is wait. Ah! I won't tell you exactly how it ends, just in case you want to see it and you haven't already for whatever reason. I don't normally dig on J-Lo, but I do so love the visuals in this one. The next couple of films I'll mention are not considered horror, but definitely give you some pretty clear water torture nonetheless. 2012's Zero Dark Thirty always gets a lot of hype for its torture scenes, which includes fucking brutal depictions of enhanced interrogation techniques that the CIA uses to extract information from detainees in the quest to find Osama bin Laden, including, of course, the classic waterboarding. And then, the year after, in 2013, a movie called Prisoners came out, which has some very uncomfortable torture scenes in it. I enjoyed this movie. Not really a horror movie, but horrific in the sense that it shows you some really dark shit. A pair of dads whose daughters have disappeared think they know who did it, and so they snatch the guy up to try and get him to talk. Some of that torture occurs in the shower. They board up the shower so it becomes an almost completely dark box, essentially. The only light comes in from a small pipe that they put in the middle for air and sound to get through. Then, to get him to talk, they rig up the pipes so that they can blast him with water that alternates as steaming hot or freezing cold. Lots of screaming, very uncomfortable scene, especially once you know that the guy being tortured didn't kidnap the girls or do anything bad to them. And he is also mentally handicapped. Yeah! How fucked up does that feel? Alright, I think that's probably enough torture for today. Before I get to story time, what, oh what, have I managed to glean from all this water torture talk? Well, first and foremost, that drowning is fucking terrifying, so I can see why things like waterboarding and the so-called water cure and even dunking were so incredibly effective at getting people to comply with whatever the fuck their torturers wanted. Information? I'll say anything you want. Contrition? I'm so fucking sorry, I swear. To be quiet, manageable, and constantly in fear of you? I am forevermore your church mouse. You can even call me that if you want. Second, I'll do a little PSA. Because provided that it's not happening through willful torture, drowning is usually highly preventable. Teach your kids to be water babies, at least enough so that they could keep their head above water without standing if they really needed to. Send them to a water safety class at the rec center or a place like that. That's what my mom did. And they did a lot of fun stuff with us. One was they made us jump in the pool with jeans and t-shirts on so that we could practice what to do if we ever fell off a cruise ship or something like that. Here's a tip to take on your next boat ride. Take your jeans or pants off. They're just going to drag you down. Just let them go. They will not keep you warm. Then pull your shirt up over your mouth, but under your nose. Tie the bottom of your shirt tight around your torso, and then inflate it as much as you possibly can using your natural breath. In through the nose, out through the mouth. Puff up that shirt. And honestly, the only other thing I can think of at this point is the phrase that always pops up a lot when I research torture methods. Humans be fucked up creatures. Definitely more so than any other animal on Earth. We are just terrifying, horrific beasts sometimes. Our minds are the scariest fucking places. We can be super awesome and creeptastic for sure. You know, we can do some really amazing and loving things for each other. But holy shit, we can also think of some depraved, depraved things to do to each other. And unfortunately, there are always going to be those among us who are willing and able to do those depraved things. And do. Alright, I like like a little sweet with my torture, a little sugar with my espresso. So tonight, you are most definitely getting a fairy tale. But don't worry, there's still death and anguish sprinkled in there for you, just in a folksy cute way that feels non-threatening. This story is called The Great Flood, and it is a folktale from China, which was translated into English by Wolfram Eberhard in his book Folktales of China, originally published in 1937. Enjoy! In a mountain village lived a woman and her son. She was more than 50 years old. Her son, Chu Chang, was exactly 19. They were very poor and earned their living by collecting firewood. Every morning, Chu Chang hung his axe on his carrying pole and went into the mountains. Every day by midday, he collected a large load of firewood, which he would take into the town to sell. With the money he received, he would buy some rice and go home, where his mother would have dinner ready for him. He would put down his stick, and while he ate the meal, he would tell his mother all that had happened during the day. By the time he had finished, it would be nightfall and time to go to bed. The next morning he would go out for firewood as usual, and his mother would cook the rice bought the day before, eat some of it, and keep the rest for her son. In this manner, the days went by. One day, Chu went to the hills as usual. His mother had finished dinner and was mending his clothes when she heard the loud clang of a gong ceaselessly beating outside. Putting down the clothes, she went to the door to see what it was, and there she found an old beggar monk. She said to him, "We are poor people and have no spare rice. You must go elsewhere." "Lord Buddha, I am so hungry," said the monk. "Please give me the rice you are saving in the pot." The woman was frightened when she heard this, because the rice pot was standing in the house, and he could not know what was in it. Fearing he might be a saint, she said to him, "The rice in the pot is really for my son, but if you are very hungry, I will give you half of it. Please wait a moment." She went back into the house, put half the rice into a bowl, and brought it out to the monk. While he was eating, he said to her, "I have something important to say to you. When your son, Chu Chang, comes home, tell him to return to town and buy some sheets of paper and some flour, prepare some paste, and then stick some straw and the paper together to make a boat. When the eyes of the two lions in front of the big temple in the village become red, you must both get into the boat, because the land here will disappear, and the town will be covered by a large lake. But remember this, if you see sparrows, ants, or snakes swimming in the water, you may save them. Men or wolves, however, you must on no account assist. Do you understand?" Then he went away. The woman looked up at the sun, and, calculating from its place in the sky that her son would soon return, she went into the house, poured the rest of the rice into a bowl, and then went out again to watch for his coming. Since there was no sign of him, she went in again and tidied up the clothes that she had mended. When he still did not come, she went and stood at the door. The sun was slowly sinking behind the hills in the west. The birds, who had already retired to their nests, were singing their bedtime songs. She became tired from standing by the door and was worried and anxious about her son. Only when it was almost dark did she see him coming, and she felt as if a load had been lifted from her heart. She saw that he had a bag on his stick and was pleased that he was bringing the rice. "Hurry," she called out. "Why are you so late today? After dinner, I have some news for you." "I have already eaten," answered the son. "As I was coming home from the hills today, I met an old man who wanted to buy all my wood. He didn't ask the price, but wanted me to carry it back to his house, which was more than 30 li, about 10 miles, away. As I put down the load, I saw a delicious-looking meal standing on the table, which the old man invited me to partake of. At first I refused, but he insisted on my eating, and being very hungry, I did take some. Afterward, I was afraid he would give me no money, but in the end he gave me twice as much as I ordinarily receive. When I told him that I had to go into town to buy rice, he suggested that I should buy a bushel of rice from him, and he gave me much more than usual." Chu Chang pointed to his bag. While they were talking, they went into the house. After putting down the bag, he asked his mother what had taken place at home during the day. She told him all about the beggar monk who had urged them to make a boat of straw and paper. But her son was skeptical and asked her, "How can a paper ship carry people?" "That's not our business," replied the mother. "This monk was really a saint, because otherwise how could he know you were called Chu Chang and that there was still some rice in the pot?" Usually Chu agreed with his mother, but this evening he thought she was wrong. However, the next morning, Chu went into the town to buy the things and then came home to paste the ship together. Meanwhile, his mother washed the rice and cooked one pot full, and then another to serve as provisions on the boat. By midday, the boat was ready, and Chu ran off to the temple to look at the lion's eyes, but seeing them as white as usual, he went home. Then he went again, but still there was no change to be seen. He returned again and again, until his mother said to him, "It is too late for them to become red today. Wait until tomorrow." During the night, neither could sleep well, and they got up long before the sun rose. Chu rubbed his eyes and ran off to the temple, while his mother packed the clothes and put them into the boat, together with the rice, a pot, a bowl, a basin, and a sieve, not even forgetting the old bed. Again and again the son went to the temple, but the eyes were still not red. In the evening, as he was running there again, people asked him why he continually went there. Chu called to them, as he hurried by, that he was going to see if the lion's eyes were red. Two young wags heard him say this and thought to themselves, "What a fool Chu is! How can the lion's eyes become red? Let us paint them ourselves and see what he does." When Chu Chang went once more, and this time saw that the eyes were red, he rushed home to tell his mother the news, helped her into the ship, and then went on board himself. Scarcely were they inside when they heard an appalling crash, and on opening their eyes again, they saw nothing but water all around. Their craft, however, was floating on the water just like a real ship, perhaps even quieter. However, it had no rudder and went wherever it wished. Chu was so horrified that he could barely utter a word, but his mother kept on murmuring, "So many people have met their death. What a disaster. The saint told me that if we saw a sparrow, a snake, or an ant swimming about, we could save them, but not a man or a wolf." Just as she spoke, a swarm of ants came by, and when they were near enough, she fished them out with the sieve. Then a snake appeared, and Chu rescued it and put it in the boat. It was nearly evening, but although it was near autumn, it was not at all cold. So they sat in the boat and looked into the water and up at the sky. Then they saw a sparrow fly by and prepare to settle on the boat, but, seeing people on board, it became frightened and flew up and down without daring to alight. Chu called out, "Sparrow, come down and I will save you." But the sparrow only flew up higher, on and on, until it became exhausted and fell into the sea. But it fell not far away, and Chu was able to reach it with his hand and rescue it. Suddenly the ship began to shake. Chu, looking around, saw a white wolf clutching the side and preparing to jump in. Chu wanted to knock it off and began to beat it, but the wolf kept jumping up, until at last Chu's mother called out, "Let it come in, my son. Poor wolf. After all, it is also a living thing." Chu ceased to hit the wolf, and it sprang into the boat. After a while, a man came swimming by, quite exhausted, and Chu asked his mother what he should do. "Of course, save him," she said. "Since we have saved a wolf, we can't very well let a man drown." The ship moved in the direction of the man, and Chu put out his arms and pulled him into the boat. He soon recovered enough to thank Chu for saving his life. He asked his name and the name of his mother, saying at the same time that he was called Wu Yi, and that, of his family of 5 people, all except he, who could swim, had been drowned. "Don't talk so much, Chu," his mother said. "Hurry and give him an old coat to change into, and then let us eat." While they were eating, Wu Yi continued, "I cannot thank you enough for rescuing me, and as a small recognition, I should like to call you elder brother, but I don't know if this idea would please you." Before Chu had time to answer, his mother said, "That is a good idea, but as Chu is much younger than you, he must call you elder brother." So Wu Yi knelt down before the mother, and Chu accepted him as his blood brother. They found so many things to talk about that they quite forgot their desperate plight. It had become dark, and on all sides the sea stretched out to the horizon. There was no wind, but the ship sailed along without the 3 persons feeling any danger. Chu fed the animals they had saved, and then they went to bed. Next morning, when they woke up, the sun was high in the sky and the boat was lying on the shore. Chu jumped ashore and looked around, but there was no sign of men. Nothing but mountains and hills. He carried his mother from the boat, and Wu Yi helped him to take off their belongings. The small animals ran off, but the wolf ran backward and forward, as if it wanted to remain with its rescuers. They chose a nice spot on the island and built themselves a house of straw and stone to live in. They still had a little rice, and so they did not suffer from hunger. Then Chu discovered that there was a town 30 li away. He and Wu collected firewood, which they took into the town and sold, thereby gaining enough for their livelihood. One day, when Chu had just felled a large tree, a thick black cloud came up from the northwest. Chu thought to himself, "In fairy tales, such black clouds are always evil spirits. I will give it a blow with my axe." As the cloud came roaring and blustering by, with all his might he hurled his axe into the air. When the axe fell down again, it was covered with blood. The cloud sped away toward the southeast, and Chu pursued it with his weapon. After chasing it for about 5 li, he saw it disappear under a stone, which, he found on going nearer, was concealing something. With a great effort, he managed to lift it up, and underneath he saw a dark hole stretching into the earth. He carefully replaced the cover and, after marking the spot, took up his axe and returned to where he had left Wu Yi. "I have been searching everywhere for you," said Wu. "Where have you been?" "I was right about the dark wind cloud," answered Chu. "There was a spirit in it, which I wounded with my axe. Look! There is still some blood on it."
"Oh, don't bother about that," said Wu Yi.
"It is almost dark and we must be getting home. Mother will be waiting at the door." Noticing that his brother was in an ill humor, Chu said no more, but stuck his axe in his belt and took the load of wood. Since it was already late, they went straight home without going into the town. When they got near home, Chu was surprised not to see his mother standing at the door. When he looked closer, he saw the wolf eating something. Yes, the wolf he had rescued from the water had killed and eaten his mother. With a roar, he raised his axe and dashed out the wolf's brains. But his mother was dead. They both wept. Wu Yi was the first to recover himself and said, "Don't weep, brother. She is dead, and all our tears won't bring her to life again. Let us carry her into the house, and tomorrow we can sell our wood and buy a coffin to bury her in." Chu wiped his eyes, and they both carried the body into the house. They began to weep again, and went to bed without eating anything. The next day, Chu stayed with the body while Wu Yi went into the town, sold the wood, and bought a miserably cheap coffin. They placed the body in it and buried it in a beautiful spot. Then they began to collect firewood again. One day, Chu went to town to sell wood. At the town gate, he put down his load and rested a while. A crowd of people were standing in front of a red notice on the gate. Being unable to read, Chu asked an old man what it was all about. The old man answered, "On such and such a day, the daughter of His Excellency Wang was carried off from the garden by an evil spirit in a cloud. The man who finds her will receive 10,000 ounces of gold, and if he is over 20 and under 30, she will become his wife." When he heard this, Chu remembered his experience a few days earlier, but before saying anything, he wanted to go home and ask his brother's advice. He took his load, went into the town, found a purchaser for the wood, and then went home. He told Wu Yi the contents of the red notice, and asked him if he would accompany him and climb down into the spirit's cave. "Of course I will go with you," Wu said. "If we don't find her, we are no worse off. If we do find her, we shall become rich and have a wife." Next morning, Chu went into the town. When he had found the house of Excellency Wang, he said to the doorkeepers, "Please tell His Excellency that I am here. I know where his daughter is hidden. I want to return her." The doorkeepers informed their master that a man had come who claimed to know where his daughter was hidden. Wang sent for him at once and asked him his name, where he came from, and what he knew about his daughter. Chu told him his name and said, "One day while I was collecting wood on the eastern hill, a dark storm cloud came up from the northwest.
As I had always heard that dark clouds were evil spirits, I decided to try to wound it with my axe. When the axe fell down again, it was all bloody. I pursued the cloud to a hole in the hills, which was covered by a stone. All this occurred on the same day that your daughter was stolen. If you are telling the truth, then she is lost beyond hope, said Wang in despair. But he became more cheerful when Chu said he would climb down the hole and look for her. Go there at once. Do you need soldiers or weapons? He asked. No, said Chu. Only a basket and a long chain, and a few bearers with a chair to bring your daughter back. Excellency Wang ordered everything to be prepared, and Chu sent a messenger to his house to tell Wu Yi all that had happened. Then he thrust his axe into his belt and set forth. Outside were gathered 50 or 60 people sent by Wang, and a large crowd of sightseers. Chu and Wu led the way, followed by the whole crowd. Spurred on by their excitement, they soon arrived at the spot. Chu said to Wu, Brother, fasten the chain to the basket and tie the bell to the other end. I will then get into the basket, and you must let me down. If I pull the chain, the bell will ring, and you must pull the basket up again at once. Then Chu tightened his belt, grabbed his axe, took the stone cover off the hole, climbed into the basket, and was let down into the hole. The farther down he went, the broader the hole became, until, about 30 or 40 feet down, he touched bottom. As he was coming down, everything was dark below and bright above. Now everything was bright below and dark above. He sprang out of the basket and looked around. The place was like a garden. Beautiful trees and flowers, such as he had never seen before, were growing everywhere. The ground was covered with such perfectly mown grass that he hardly dared walk on it. To the west, he could see an artificial mountain. Although it was light, there was no sun in the sky. Chu did not waste time looking at all these wonders, but, holding his axe, he set off in the direction of the artificial mountain. From there, he would be able to see everything. Before he reached it, he heard a terrible noise, and, turning around, he saw a stone house among the trees. With great care, he peeped through the door, and there he saw an ogre asleep in a chair. It had a gray-blue face, red hair and a red beard, and huge lips, through which two great tusks protruded from its mouth. It was wearing a long, old-fashioned black robe and black trousers, beneath which could be seen a black foot covered with golden hair. On the foot was a great, bleeding wound. A bowl of hot water stood on the ground beside it, and on its left sat a beautiful young maiden with a pale and tragic face, who was continually wiping the sore with a sponge and hot water. Chu coughed slightly until the maiden heard him. She motioned him to go a little to the side so that the ogre should not see him, and then she went out to him. Chu asked her, Are you not the daughter of Excellency Wang? Yes, she said, but why have you come here? I am looking for you, he replied. Oh, she sighed, the ogre is so dangerous. It has 7 heads, and if one is cut off, another grows at once. A few days ago it was wounded in the foot by a woodcutter, and I have to wash the wound. At the moment, it is sleeping. Just then, there was a rumbling sound, and the ogre awoke. The girl signaled to Chu to hide in the woods, and, returning to the spirit, she continued to wash its wound with the sponge. The ogre rolled its eyes and roared, I smell human flesh. But master, cried the maiden, I have not been here long. Perhaps I still smell of human flesh. Satisfied by this, the ogre went to sleep again. Chu silently ran back to the entrance, tugged the chain to have the basket let down, and then climbed into it and was rapidly pulled up. The maiden is there, he told the excited people. But the spirit is very dangerous. It has 7 heads, but I will find a way to dispose of it. Then he said to Wu, When I have killed the spirit, I shall send the maiden up first, and then come up myself. Wu nodded, but already an evil plan was forming in his mind. Chu, however, suspected nothing, and let himself down once more. When he arrived at the bottom, he gripped his axe, crept through the woods to the door, and listened until he was sure the ogre was asleep. The girl was still washing the wounded foot with hot water. When she glanced up, he showed her the axe, and she nodded assent. He crept up behind the ogre and cut off one head, but immediately a new one grew, which he also cut off. Only after the last head had fallen was there any blood. "Now it is dead," said the maiden. "But why did you take such risks for me?" Chu told her everything, and she said to him, "As one never knows what may happen to one, I will give you a token." Taking a golden clasp from her hair, she broke it in half and gave Chu one of the pieces. "This is your token," she continued, "and 3 years is the appointed time, after which it is no longer good." Chu hid the clasp in his clothes and, leading the maiden to the basket, he shook the chain. Wu knew that the maiden would come up now, and he quickly pulled the chain. Yes, she was very beautiful. The maidservants that Wang had sent led her to the litter and stood around her. Then Wu called out, "Quickly, close the hole! The spirit is coming!" The people had turned to look at the maiden and did not remember that someone was still in the hole. Now they all ran up and helped Wu fill up the hole, and then, amidst rejoicing, they returned to Wang's house. Wang had no sooner seen Wu than he said, "This is not Chu Cheng. He was at most 20 years old, and you are more than 30. How dare you pretend to be Chu?" Then Wu answered, "Chu asked me to come instead of him, but I will bring him." He went out, wondering to himself what he could do and whether he would have to go out and collect firewood again. Chu was waiting for the basket to descend again, when suddenly a shower of sand and stones poured down and nearly killed him. Then the stones stopped falling, but there was no sign of the chain. He saw that the hole had been closed. Sighing, he thought to himself that his end was near, because nowhere could he find another exit from the cavern. "Whether the hole has been shut or not does not matter, because I cannot get out without a basket and chain. I can only await my death." He wandered aimlessly about, until suddenly he saw a little white dragon sitting on a pedestal, swishing its tail. Seeing it fastened with a nail, he went up and pulled the nail out to let the dragon get down, and said, "We are companions in sorrow." Meanwhile, he had become very hungry because he had eaten nothing the whole day. He sat down on a stone to see what the dragon would do. It came to the stone he was sitting on, licked it with its tongue, then wriggled back to the grass, curled up, and went to sleep. Chu was very hungry, but there was nothing to do except lie down and try to sleep. When he awoke, he was still hungrier. Day and night were the same, and therefore he did not know how long he had slept. The little dragon wriggled up again, licked the stone, and then went back to sleep. Wondering why it did this, Chu decided to try it himself. The moment his tongue touched the stone, his hunger and thirst left him. He was delighted with this discovery, because now his most pressing need was solved. He licked the stone, slept, and admired the flowers and trees. In this manner the time passed, without his knowing. One day when he was fast asleep, he heard someone call his name. He was very surprised, since he could see no living thing except the dragon, which was lying at his feet. "Did you call me?" Chu asked the dragon. "Yes, I did. I want to repay your kindness," it replied. "Tomorrow is the day on which I fly up to Earth." "What day is tomorrow?" asked Chu. "Tomorrow is the second day of the second month," said the dragon. "Punctually at midday I fly up and can take you with me." "How can you know that tomorrow is the second day of the second month?" asked Chu. "And how do you know when it is noon? You cannot see the sun here." "I can feel it," replied the dragon. Without saying another word, it hurried off. Chu, naturally, was overjoyed. He decided to take home a bit of the stone that allayed hunger and thirst. Although he hacked at it with his axe until his arms ached, he could not break off even the tiniest piece. Seeing it was hopeless, he went for a walk in the garden, then licked the stone for the last time and went to sleep. When he awoke, the dragon was lying by his side. "Is it time to go?" he asked. "Yes," said the dragon, curling itself up. "You must get on my back, shut your eyes, and not open them again until I tell you. Hold my horns tightly." Then Chu heard a clap of thunder, and the wind whistled in his ears. "Open your eyes," said the dragon a moment later. Chu found himself falling gently into a heap of grass, outside the town of Excellency Wang. When he learned in the town that Wang's daughter was not yet married, he went to the house and announced his arrival. But he had been so long in the hole, where there was no sun, that his skin had turned a dirty yellow color, and his clothes were hanging in rags. Believing him to be an impostor, Wang greeted him in a distant manner, but he did not venture to send him away. Instead, he thought of a difficult test and said to Chu, "Although you say you are Chu Chang, I cannot recognize you. Perhaps my daughter could do so, but first I shall set you a task. If you can do it, you may see my daughter." Chu asked hesitatingly what the task was. "I have 2 bushels of beans," said Wang. "There are 2 kinds. One is yellow, the other black. The 2 kinds are mixed, and you must separate them in 30 days. Then he called the servants and, ordering them to lock Chu up in an empty room, he gave him the beans. Chu did not dare refuse, but he was very depressed and thought, "This is a clear refusal of the wedding. But why does he set me such a hard task if he does not want the marriage to take place?" After looking at the beans, he lay down to sleep, since it was impossible to separate them. Then a flock of sparrows appeared. Some picked out the yellow beans, others the black, and soon they were all divided. At dusk, the servant returned. When he saw the beans already separated, and Chu sleeping peacefully on the ground, he called out, "Mr. Chu, how did you complete the task so quickly?" Chu woke up to see the servant standing in front of him, and the beans nicely divided into 2 piles. But he was careful not to utter a word, because he had no idea who had divided them. The servant, however, thought he was in a bad temper, and went off laughing to inform his master of what had happened. When Wang heard of it, he mixed a bushel of rice with a bushel of corn, and ordered Chu to separate it during the night. Chu, however, was so angry that he decided to do nothing but lie down and go to sleep. Then many, many ants came and divided the seeds for him, so that when he awoke, he saw that the task was done. He could scarcely believe his eyes and wondered to himself what spirit was helping him. In a short while, the servant arrived, saw the rice and corn divided, and went to tell his master. Wang did not believe it and went in person to see the 2 heaps, but not a single seed was in the wrong place. However, he set 1 more task. In the west room of the treasure chamber, there were 10 bars of gold. If Chu could carry them into the east room, Wang would take him at once to his daughter, but if he failed, Wang would have him executed. While Chu was being led to the treasure chamber, he was quite happy because he thought it would be easy to take 10 bars of gold from one room to another. To his horror, he found them more like pillars than bars. Each one was 10 times as heavy as anything he could move. He thought to himself, "Well, I shall certainly have to die this time, but at least I shall sleep first." While he was sleeping, snakes came and rolled the bars, one after another, into the east room, so that when Chu awoke, he saw with delight that all the gold was already moved. "Certainly some god is helping me," he thought. Then he asked to be brought before Wang. "I have fulfilled all the tasks that you gave me," he said. "Now you must fulfill your promise without giving me any more tasks." Wang first went to the treasure chamber to see if the bars had really been moved. When he saw them all in the east room, he thought, "He certainly must be Chu Chang. If he had not been so strong and wise, he would never have managed to kill the evil spirit." But to Chu Chang he said, "It is possible that you are the real Chu Chang, but I have no means of deciding. First, my daughter must see you." Then a maidservant led him to the door of the lady's apartments and told him to wait. Through pearl door hanging, marvelous perfumes were wafted toward him, making his senses reel. From inside, he heard a voice ask, "Have you the token?" He took the half of the golden clasp out of his breast pocket and gave it to the maid. The daughter compared it with her own, and then ordered the maids to take Chu to the guest rooms and inform her father. Wang led him to the bath, and when he was washed, he gave him a beautiful gown. He sent for the calendar and, seeing that the next day was favorable for weddings, he decided that they should be married at once. There is no need to tell what a sumptuous room Chu was given and what a marvelous bed he slept on. Next day, all the relations, friends, and guests were there. Great trumpets blared, and everyone was very happy. The bride and bridegroom made their obeisance to heaven and to earth, and then went into the bridal chamber. When they both had drunk many cups of wine, and all the servants and other people had left them, his wife asked him softly, "Beloved, why did you come so late?" Then Chu Chang told her everything that had happened since their separation. How incalculable is the course of life. They went on talking for a long time, till suddenly they heard shouting and screaming in the court. The young wife called to the maid, "Autumn Scent, what is the matter?" "A thief fell down from the chimney and was killed," replied the maid. Chu went out to see, and the maid led the way with a candle. Outside in the courtyard, the torches shone as bright as day, and Chu saw that the dead man was his blood brother, Wu Yi. Chu no longer had to collect firewood, but lived happily ever after. The end. That's all I got for this episode of Creeptastic. Thank you, as always, for taking the time to listen. If you liked what you heard, please feel free to leave me a review wherever you might have listened, and or you can hop over to patreon.com/creeptastic and maybe become a patron of the show. To find all the links to my Patreon page and all my social media, including Instagram, where I post any accompanying photos for episodes, please visit the Creeptastic website at creeptastic.com. And if you want to talk to me about literally anything in this or another episode, I would love to hear from you. I value feedback, I value suggestions, bring it on. You can email me at caroline@creeptastic.com or find me on social media. The website is creeptastic.com. I am Caroline. Have a wonderful, fabulous week, and of course, always be your creeptastic self.